morning. Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And this show is also podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. So, later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Lorenzo DiStefano about his movie, wonderful documentary called Los Zafiros, Music from the Edge of Time. Right now, joining us by telephone, I'd like to welcome Ellen Bravo. She's the author of the book, Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. Welcome, Ellen Bravo.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, the obvious question is, who are the big boys?
Well, the big boys are what I call the powers that be, the people who control wealth and power. You may call them the ruling class or the owning class or the man. They're the people who make the key decisions about how we do our work. They make or either greatly influence public policy. And, you know, the problem is they not only get to own the world, they get to define it. So, you know, we may get to oppose their views every once in a while, but mainly it's their voices who are heard in the media.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, that's an excellent and important point, is that when you not only run the world, but define it, you get to tell the stories about it. What are some of the stories that the, you know, the so-called big boys tell people about the world they're living in that you challenge?
Well, for example, they say they get to define whether there is a problem, what the problem is, and what the solution is. So when it comes to women, this is what they're saying now. Women actually have no problems. They can be anything they want. Look at Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. And if there aren't very many women in the best-paying jobs, well, it's because they choose not to be there. They'd rather be home with their kids. And that's okay, because motherhood is the most important job unless you're poor, in which case you better get yourself a job no matter what, no matter what hours. And if you never see your kids or they're home alone, well, at least they have their pride. That's their vision of what's happening today for women. And if women are angry about this, who should they be angry at? Each other, of course. We have the mommy wars. Women who are paid in employment versus moms who are not paid at home. Women with kids versus women without kids at the workplace. When really, all of us should be angry together at the big boys and working for change.
One of the points you make is that women are still paid considerably less than men. I mean, I remember walking around with buttons that said 69 cents on them. Women made 69 cents to every dollar that men made. But there's still real differentials, and it has to do with what kind of work is women's work. I mean, psychiatrists get more money than than social workers, let's say, or many of those types of men's and women's. Why is that? I mean, what is the mechanism that keeps that in place?
Well, you know, it's really great. The big boys are going to say the reason women make less money is because they trade income for flexibility, neglecting the fact that the lowest paid jobs are, in fact, the least flexible. And then they'll say, well, you know what? It's because women don't ask. If they just asked for more money, then we'd be equal. It is true that women could do a better job learning how to negotiate, but the main reason women make so little money is their employers pay them so little money, and they do that because they can. For example, the key problem is the undervaluation of women's work, just because women do it. And this comes from the legacy of, it used to be perfectly legal to pay women half or two-thirds as much as men for doing exactly the same job. You might wonder why the most trusted advisors of the president are called secretary. That's what secretaries used to be. And then they needed women to do it and many other jobs, paid them less. More and more women did those jobs. And pretty soon, the discriminatory rate became the market rate. And that's been embedded, that legacy of discrimination. This is also why the people who take care of young children make less than the people who take care of our cars, our pets, our lawns, because they do for a living what women do for free in the home. So the undervaluation of women's work is a major part of it, but it's also because women lack bargaining power. It's because women are more clustered in minimum wage jobs, which, you know, has lost so much value that even if the current raise went through, we'd be at 1956 value, and so on. And plus, there's a huge mommy penalty. The biggest wage gap is that between mothers with kids and everybody else. And that's been increasing, not decreasing. It's also true, by the way, that to the extent that the wage gap has narrowed, half of that difference came from loss of pay by men, particularly men of color. This is not what we had in mind by equality.
That's a really important point.
Yes, it's a very important point. So, you know, what we say is, let's get rid of these myths of the big boys. Let's know what the reality is. There are feminist solutions to these, mainly revaluing women's work, raising women's bargaining power, raising the floor of wages, getting rid of the mommy penalty. And my book gives both the framing but also organizing tips on how to do this.
I can see raising the floor, raising the minimum wage, for example, raising what certain jobs are paid through union activity, but raising the, if you do it legally, specifically for women, it seems like there would be snags in that.
Well, there's two ways you have to do it. One is, there's a piece of legislation right now in Congress, has been pending for years, the Fair Pay Act. And what the Fair Pay Act says is that you would do job evaluation in an objective way. We know how to do this. That's the good news. There are places in the whole cities and provinces in Canada, for example, that do this, where you have objective criteria to determine the worth of skills, effort, responsibility, consequence of action, etc. Right now, our job evaluation systems themselves are very biased. For example, my favorite example from this is that women who sew the bindery of books when their job was evaluated originally were given 0 points for the skill of binding because it was assumed that all women know how to sew.
Oh, my goodness.
Our nurses originally were rated 0 on how pleasant their jobs were, and the question that was used to determine it was, do you work with grease? Because it was simply taken from an industrial model. Well, no, they don't work with grease, but obviously they work with other unpleasant substances. So we have to, you know, we have to go back and just remove those kinds of questions and their modern-day counterparts and really determine what jobs are worth. That works especially when there are jobs that you can compare. What do you do about child care providers who work in a system where there isn't anybody else you can compare? Well, you take the principle of this, revaluing the skill of those jobs and really thinking about what's involved. The main problem for women isn't that they're unskilled, but that their skills are undervalued. Yes, they need more education. There are lots of things that could help, just as men do. Women and men obviously are not are pretty parallel now in education. And low-wage jobs, people can gain more skills. But especially we need to revalue the skills those jobs have. And that will best come, I think, through collective bargaining in the jobs that are not, in a place where you can do this kind of comparable evaluation.
I have to say, reading Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickeled and Dimed, she said somewhere in that book, she said, I will never call any job unskilled again after
exactly.
after she worked at Walmart and found out how hard it was.
Exactly. Really.
What are some of the differences that mothers face versus women without children in the workplace, both in terms of just job discrimination in the first place and in terms of the quality of their lives?
Well, I want to talk about two things. The second is flexibility for family care. This really applies to everyone because even if you don't have kids and are not a parent, you have parents, and even if your parents are gone, you may have a partner or you yourself could become sick. So the changes we want in terms of flexibility for caregiving apply to everyone. And this is one of the best examples of where the big boys try to pit women with kids against everybody else, when in fact we all have these things in common. The other reason why all women should support getting rid of discrimination against mothers is that it's essentially a devaluing of women. There, you know, lots of tests have shown this bias against mothers. Women are seen as competent until they have kids, and then they're seen as equivalent to people who have serious mental or physical disabilities. Of course, that reflects another kind of bias in our society, but it shows you how much belittling there is, as if having a baby changes your brain. You know, Pat Schroeder, when she ran for Congress, was always asked, how are you going to do it? How are you going to have kids and this job in Congress? Even though her opponent, who had 6 kids, was never asked that question.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest double standards. I mean, I can't remember who it was who was quoted as saying, I can't wait for the day when a man says, I'm really struggling with the choice between a career and family.
Right. Well, the truth is men have said that. And one of the things it shows, there are more men today. I mean, if you're a low-wage man, you struggle with that every day because you don't have any flexibility either. And there are a lot more men today, even in professional jobs, who want their kids to know them. You know, I tell this story in the book of a guy who traveled a lot for his job, often missed the events with his son, Timmy. Timmy was talking to him while he was packing and wanting to go play catch, and he explained he couldn't because he had to get ready. And he said, Timmy, you know, I hate it when I miss your games when I'm gone. I really miss them. And I know that you and Mommy miss me a lot, too. And Timmy said, I do, Daddy, but I miss you most when you're home. There are a lot of kids who are missing their dads when they're home. And, you know, there are men who want to change this. This is why what I talk about in the book is that we have to not just smash the glass ceiling, but redesign the building from the bottom up to benefit women and men. This would be a much more rational way to do things. There's a company called SAS Software in North Carolina that's a good example of what the world could look like. This is the good news, by the way. Everything I talk about in the book does exist somewhere, and it works, sometimes in whole countries, sometimes in individual companies in the U.S. And what it means is they have a 35-hour work week. Nobody works more than 45 hours a week, including the CEO. The gates close at 6. The people are not expected to take work home because the boss really gets it, the owner of this company, that people work better when they're refreshed. There is, you know, there are all these child care centers, a health care center, et cetera, and lots of collaborative work. Guess what? This company has never had a down year. They have a 98% renewal rate on their subscriptions. That's how people use them. Because of the great relationships people have with staff who never leave. And so people get to know them and care about them and feel like they're paid much more attention to. The quality of work, in other words, is better. FaceTime has become synonymous with advancement. You really have to be able to move, meet, or travel at a moment's notice in order to move up in corporate America. Well, that means you need to have a wife at home or no life. We have to change that criterion for success, and we can only change that if we change the way work is organized. This is not a favor to women. It's a better way to run a company, to run a country, and to run a family.
We're talking to Ellen Bravo. She's the author of the book, Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. There was a section in the book where you quoted Jack Welch, the former head of General Electric, in a book that he wrote called Winning. And I don't know why this should be so shocking to me, but I read it, and it just made me sick to my stomach. He said, you know, it's not a... I can't remember the exact quote, but basically, managers should not be so worried about giving people flexibility. They should be worried about making the job so interesting that the rest of their life falls away.
Exactly. And he talked about what a blast he had coming to work on the weekends. Well, he may have had a blast, but it's unlikely that most of the other people there had a blast. I had a student, I teach this graduate class on family-friendly workplaces, and I asked them to write a reply to him to this statement, because he also talked about how work family is basically lip service. And shut up and figure it out on your own, or you're going to be seen as incompetent and uncommitted. And this one student's mother had worked at GE and most of her life. And this young woman said, you know, growing up, she had originally thought it was her mom's fault, that her mom just wasn't a very good mom and didn't care about her. And now, of course, she learned through this class that it was GE's fault that making her mother put in these hours. And she said, thanks, her mom was a single mother, she said, thanks a lot, Jack Welch, from the daughter of a GE employee who from the age of 8 cooked her own meals, whose mother never once came to any of her school or sporting activities. You know, you've ruined my life growing up. And it was really an eye-opener, I think, what it means, what the impact of these things are on our kids. It's not, if we care about the well-being of children, then we have to care about what happens their parents at work.
It's such an example of one of the internal contradictions of conservative ideology, which is this kind of free market capitalism on the one hand and this supposedly pro-family stance on the other.
Yeah, well, the truth is family values stop at the workplace door in most companies in the United States. And, you know, we have a government that says it cares about families but doesn't value them. And if we really do value them, then we have to make it so that people don't have to choose between being a good employee and being a good family member. And today in this country, every day, we make people make that choice.
Why is the United States so far behind other countries in health care, maternity, paternity leave, and child care?
Isn't that a good question? I think there are several reasons. One of them is the power of the labor movement. Clearly, in these other countries in Europe, but it isn't just Europe, everywhere, 168 countries, 163 of them are better than we are in these things. So a lot of emerging countries as well. So one is the power of the labor movement. The other is that there's less power in the hands of the big boys. The ability to determine public policy is less left to the hands of those who own wealth and power. That's the problem. And we have, you know, we have an ideology here that justify the big boys' status quo by saying, you know, individualism, don't tell companies how to do their job. Well, this is really about, we need to reframe this as minimum labor standards. This is the proper role of government to make sure, just as we got rid of child labor and got rid of discrimination on many bases and got, you know, said there has to be at least a floor of what we pay people, we also need a floor for whether people can have flexibility to care for loved ones. You know, we don't have wives at home. If we, some families, of course, never did, but today most don't. We have to change the workplace to fit the changes in the workforce.
We're talking to Ellen Bravo. You talk about some of the typical reactions to feminism, and we don't really have to go into it here, but feminism is not considered the nicest word of all possible labels that people want to use for themselves. But some of these reactions are demonizing, minimizing, catastrophizing, trivializing, compartmentalizing, and patronizing. And when you talked about these in your book, I've, of course, recognized every one of them so clearly. What are some examples of, for example, demonizing, trivializing, and so on?
Well, let's take the work-family issue. Minimizing it is, what are you talking about? All companies are family-friendly. Trivializing it is, oh, you want men to have time off? They're just going to go hunting and fishing. They don't really care about their kids. Patronizing is, oh, you just don't understand how business works, honey. You don't get what, you know, what we need to do to stay afloat and give you jobs. Catastrophizing is, well, you pass this law for paid sick days or paid family medical leave, businesses will flee, the world will end as we know it, you know, the sky will fall. Demonizing is, hey, you can't figure out how to take care of those kids. You shouldn't have had them in the first place. And compartmentalizing is, let's make the ones with kids be mad at the ones without kids and vice versa. When really what we need to say is having a family shouldn't cost you your job. We have a public stake in the well-being of kids and, for that matter, elderly adults. We have a community interest in this, and we need to have solutions that help parents be the good caregivers they want to be.
There's a chapter in the book about women doing men's jobs, and I wondered, what are some of the examples of what would have been considered men's jobs, say, 50 or 100 years ago, that are now really shared between men and women?
Well, there are jobs that were done only by men that are now done mainly by women, like secretary, for example, or caregivers of all kinds, nurses and so on. But there are also jobs that were mainly out of women's reach, everything from craft jobs to neurosurgeon to stockbroker, et cetera, where women are still in a minority. And the big boys say either they just don't have what it takes, or, you know, they're not willing to put in the long hours required. When the truth is, the main reason women don't do as well as men in these jobs is they aren't given the goods. They aren't given the leads, the training, the mentoring, the opportunity, the promotions, the rewards. It's not about women not performing. It's about either their performance not being recognized or they're not being given the space in which to perform. And then, you know, there's a recent sex discrimination settlement, $46 million at Morgan Stanley. Every couple years we have another one of these big cases that reveals these huge discrepancies in the financial industry, for example, but it could be many other industries as well. And, you know, the company pledges to do better and pays out all this money, but nothing essentially changes about the way work is designed. I have a friend who's a stockbroker, and she described a lot of this, and I quote her in the book. She said, you know, it's not always evil intentions. It's just the good old boy network. So if some guy is having a bad time, not doing well on the job, and the boss slips him some good leads because he feels bad for him, whereas if a woman did that, she'd be out. Or some broker moves on, and people go into the boss to make the case for getting his clients. Oh, I know that person's brother-in-law. Oh, I go golfing with them. Instead of there being a transparent, objective, clear way of determining of equitable distribution. This is what happens over and over again in the workplace. It's also true, you know, when I said in the beginning you asked how the big boys say that because women don't ask for equal pay that they don't get it. And there is some truth to this about women not negotiating. But what we forget is in most jobs, women have no right to negotiate over their pay. And in many jobs, if you talk to each other about pay, you can be fired. There's salary secrecy. And this isn't just true in low-wage jobs. In many high-wage jobs, women are prevented from talking to each other about how much people are making. Well, it's hard to know if you're being discriminated against if you don't know what the others are making, particularly, you know, women and men or whites and people of color, et cetera. So these are some of the structural changes we need to make.
I think it's a really important point that the big boys network or the old boys network is difficult to expose because it's unconscious. And this whole idea of people helping their own, people helping people like them. Do you see that with women? Women helping each other?
There are some positive examples of women obviously trying to make their own networks and mentor, and not necessarily only women, but help hook women up with women or men who could help them gain opportunities. And that's all good. And there are some companies that have done this in a quite systematic way, setting up networks. There are two things we have to be careful of. The one is that sometimes these programs really are act as if women have deficits that need to be fixed. So let's say they'll teach them how to play golf because the deals are made on the golf course, as if it were women not knowing how to play golf that was the problem, rather than where the deal got made. Second thing is the most important. What we really need is to make pay and opportunities, like I said, transparent, objective, and equitable. It shouldn't be how glib you are that determines how much money you make on your first or any other job. It should be what your skill, experience, and talents are. And if you have more experience and skill than I do, fair enough, you should be in a higher category. But let me just know what that is. And then let me know what I have to do to get into that category, rather than you knew how to smooth talk and I didn't.
There's a great example in the book where a woman who's a secretary is taking dictation from her boss for a job description for somebody else in the company who'd been passed over for promotions before, and she's very happy that this guy's finally going to be promoted until she realizes that the job description is actually her own job, and her boss never even considered hiring her for it because she was a secretary.
This was such a striking story. She was the executive secretary to a high-level vice president, and when she pointed out to him that 15 of the 17 job descriptions she was writing about were things she already did, he said, yeah, but you don't do the other two. And she said, well, neither does this guy, as she knew very well, because she'd been typing his job description all these years. And I said to her, what did he do after you pointed this out? You know, did he offer you the job? And she looked down and said, the next day I got flowers. And clearly, he didn't change his view of her because she was just a secretary, even though she was already doing the job. Title shouldn't be the thing that determines what skills are recognized.
We're talking to Ellen Bravo. There's so much more to talk about, and we're running out of time, but I want to ask you a few more things. First of all, what is 9 to 5? Not the movie, but the organization, which you talk about throughout the book.
Well, actually, the organization inspired the movie 9 to 5. So I worked at 9 to 5 for 22 years. It's a great grassroots organization of mainly low-wage women that works to win economic justice. And the best thing about it, and one of the reasons why I was so proud to describe this experience of the activists in 9 to 5, is it shows that ordinary women, when they work together, can make incredible change. The organizations I describe, in addition to 9 to 5, are just like them, often unheard of by most people, and yet doing these extraordinary campaigns. So I tried to profile at least one other group in every chapter. And really my message to everyone that reads this book is we are the change we're looking for. We can make this happen, especially if we work together on behalf of everyone in an organization, and particularly if those organizations are part of a movement for long-term systemic change. I tell the story at the end of the book about a student in my Introduction to Women's Studies class, I'm now teaching at UW-Milwaukee, who wrote an essay and said, you know, I don't think I can call myself a feminist because I haven't been an activist, but here's three things I did do this semester. And she describes supporting a friend who was trying to leave an abusive relationship, taking on a doctor who told her not to worry about the lump in her breast because she was so young, and taking on a teacher who made a racist remark to her son. And I said, you bet you're a feminist and an activist. This is what it means to find your voice and take a stand. And so I give people this little shorthand called DREAM. The D means dare to imagine the world we deserve to live in, and don't stop striving for it, even if it takes us step by step to get there. R is reach out and take somebody on this journey with you. E is educate ourselves, and there's lots of examples of alternative resources and shows like yours where we can do that. A means act, and I have pages and pages of things you can do even if you have very little time and really no money. But M is the most important. M is multiply. Grow these organizations. Become part of this movement.
When you take this message out, as you do, I mean, you have spoken to, you know, thousands and thousands of people. I imagine a lot of women get it. What about the men whom you speak to? Because this is about how feminism is good for families, business, and the nation.
As soon as men hear what I'm really saying, you know, I start the book with this story of my husband going to buy a bike the day after I'd been on a TV interview show in Milwaukee. And the guy, when he saw my name on the check with my husband's name, pointed to it and said to him, you live with her? And Larry said, well, that's my wife. And the guy said, you know, I heard her on that show last night. You want to know something amazing? She didn't say one thing I didn't agree with, and she even made me laugh. Well, you know, what did he think I was going to say? What the big boys tell him I'm going to say is, men are pigs, down with men. Women who stay home with their kids are stupid. They're wasting their lives. And, of course, I don't talk about that. I talk about what men and women have to gain when we change the workplace. And so I have that experience over and over. Men will come up and tell me about when their wives started working and made so little money. They didn't think much about it because they saw it as extras for the family. And then the man would say, I got laid off. And all of a sudden, her salary was her only income. And I think, wait a minute, she's smart. She works hard. How come she makes so little money? First time they'd ever thought about that. They understand that they have a stake in women getting fair pay, and they have a stake in women not getting fired when they have a sick kid. In fact, they have a stake in changing their relationship with their own kids. One time Larry and I were on this TV show debate, and there was a woman who'd written an op-ed saying, all problems in the family from teenage suicide to alcoholism are because of mothers who work outside the home. And so I'd been asked to debate her, but she'd only go on if her husband went on. So Larry went on with me. The men never got to speak because she and I were at each other right away, but he got to say one thing, and what he said was, men should be so grateful to the women's movement because they've given us parenting. And even though it's a huge responsibility, it's such a joy, and we should just say thanks. I think there are a lot of men who say that, even though they have changing to do, who realize that the end of that picture is a much better, healthier family structure and a much better society.
Ellen Bravo, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure, and I have a website, ellenbravo.com. I invite your readers to look at it and to order the book.
The book is called Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. We're going to take a break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR.
Era trigueña bonita, de labios como rubí, era una linda.
And this is, in the background, music of Los Zafiros. I'd like to welcome by telephone Lorenzo De Stefano, who's a filmmaker, and his film is called Los Zafiros, Music from the Edge of Time. Welcome, Lorenzo, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Good morning.
Now, Los Zafiros were what you might call a Cuban doo-wop group, sort of the Latin equivalent of the Platters. What were their musical roots? Were they an imitation of the American thing, or what was going on with Los Zafiros?
Well, I think it was more of a tribute than an imitation. You know, after the revolution, the doors kind of closed there in Cuba in terms of cultural exchange. So the Zafiros began in 1962, probably as a tribute to the Platters and other American R&B groups that they had heard previous.
Now, this was an unusual kind of group for Cuba because you had basically all vocalists and only one instrument, the guitar, no percussion. How did they arrive at that arrangement?
Well, there seems to be a tradition of vocal quartets in Cuba, and of course in America as well during that period. They did take on percussion occasionally for recording sessions and some gigs, but primarily it was Manuel Galban on guitar and alternately on piano, and this wonderful arrangements for voice that they came up with.
How did the five members of this group come together?
They were basically street guys from Cayo Hueso, from the neighborhood in Havana, and two of the original members, Kiki Morua and Miguel Cancio, kind of cooked up the idea and then went looking for others, and then they found Ignacio Elejalde, the man with the beautiful counter-tenor voice, and then El Chino Hernandez joined, and then after some original starts with other musicians, they brought on Manuel Galban. So it's kind of a random thing. There's certainly no training there, no education musically, just guys with talents, you know, who came together.
It's quite amazing. I mean, was the group led? I mean, none of them had any musical training at all. Was there not a band leader who'd gone to conservatory or something like that?
Well, Manuel Galban is musically trained, and they also worked with very skilled Cuban composers. There was a producer at the time named Nestor Mili, who I think provided them with one of their early hits, La Caminadora. But basically, it was this natural talent used together through friendship and then Galban basically being the glue for all of that, you know.
And Manuel Galban has gone on to have an amazing career throughout his whole life. I mean, this is now over four decades later. He played with groups like Vieja Trova, Santa Yera, Buena Vista Social Club.
Yes, he played for many years with Ibrahim Ferrer, who, as you know, just died, and he continues to play in the Buena Vista family with Cachaita Lopez, and then he won a Grammy with Ry Cooder in 03 with a album called Mambo Sinuendo, two guitars. So he's celebrated. He's like the surf guitar master of Cuba, you know.
Now, dancing was part of the act of Los Zafiros as well, again with some American influence there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a Motown touch there. They coordinated dance steps. It was very tight, but relaxed, probably in the Cuban mode, you know, sharkskin suits, thin leg pants, that whole look of elegance and sexuality was something they picked up on and took to another level, you know.
Why don't we hear this song for a moment? Marilyn, just turn up the volume for a moment.
Perdido tu amor, no podré disfrutar de felicidad. Sí, destino fijo, como el humo voy, surcando el espacio, buscándote estoy, tal vez no te encuentre. Quizás te perdí,
para siempre, amor.
Recordaré tu mirar, tu sentir. No lo puedo evitar.
Y sufriré añorando el ayer.
No te puedo olvidar.
Herido de sombra, por tu ausencia estoy. Solo la penumbra acompaña hoy. Perdido tu amor, no podré ser feliz.
We're talking to Lorenzo De Stefano. The film is called Los Zafiros, Music from the Edge of Time. How was this group received in the early 60s in Cuba? What were the audiences like?
Well, from all accounts, it was a phenomenal success from the very beginning. We talked to a lot of people now older, of course, who were there at the various engagements throughout Cuba. And this group provided the soundtrack of their lives. Really, people had sex for the first time with this music that played at their weddings. The connections are deep and lasting. And then, of course, a newer generation picking up on them. And the lucky people in Europe who were able to hear them. Of course, they were denied to us in the West, in the U.S., because of the embargo and the Cold War conflicts of the early 60s. But phenomenal. That's why they called them the Beatles of 1960s Cuba, not so much for the sound, not at all for the sound, but for the adoration, you know.
And they were not heard outside of Cuba. How did they become known many years later?
Well, they actually were heard outside of Cuba. They took two tours with the Grand Music Hall of Cuba, which was kind of a review. It seems that a lot of countries put out these extensive reviews with maybe 100 artists traveling. It's sort of a PR thing, you know, for the country and for the culture. And they went on several tours to Paris, Warsaw, Berlin, Moscow, with other Cuban artists. And so they became known and appreciated there, and of course in Cuba.
And it was actually interesting. There's a moment in the film where they are on tour and somebody says, "Do you want to move to the United States?" and actually hands them a blank check, and they still say no.
Yeah, that's a story told by El Chino in his later years. Of course, he had alcohol problems and told many a tall tale. We don't know the accuracy of that, but apparently it did happen. There was some mention that person might have been Berry Gordy from Motown, never substantiated, you know. But apparently someone tried to lure them away, and, you know, they were loyal Cubans. Of course, they all had families back there, and they weren't about to jump ship. But it was an interesting little political anecdote there, you know.
The film is called Los Zafiros, Music from the Edge of Time. I think it's also really important to note that although they were not trained musically, by and large, they were very serious about the music and took a great deal of care in their arrangements and in their recording. Pop music in Cuba, in a way, is a different thing than in the United States. It's treated like any other kind of music, like classical or anything else.
That's very astute. Yeah, I think that's true. Nick Gold, who produced the Buena Vista Social Club records, is interviewed in my film, and he says just that so it was pop music. It was considered art, and of course in those days there were no overdubs, no drop-in corrections. Everything had to be done in one take. And as Galban says, these recordings were made with blood and fire, and very difficult to get it right. You know, these are basically 2 or 3 minute pop love songs, done with a high degree of art and professionalism. And so, yeah, it's very special.
Now, how long did the group stay together?
A little over 10 years in that initial incarnation. They came apart through varying degrees of upset between the members. The alcohol took its toll. Just too much too soon, based on what some observers have said. And then illness took two of the members, Ignacio and Kiki, in their late 30s. That was alcohol-related syndrome. And El Chino did a long slide death in 1995, also very much alcohol-related. So the film is a tribute to them and a vehicle for the reunion of Miguel Cancio, who lives in Miami, and Manuel Galban, who lives in Havana, to come together and remember those days.
And it's a very poignant reunion, and I think one of the main themes of the film is the tremendously sentimental and profound love of Cuba and love of Havana.
From the members, you mean? Or from the filmmaker, you mean?
From the members, and I think one can't help but feel that from the film.
Yes, well, it's true. You know, I do love the place, and troubled as it is, it's a gorgeous city, and the people keep it very special, as special as they can afford to. I think that, I was early on conceived of this, some of their songs like Havana, Mi Amor, to be almost music videos, with new footage that we shot, to bring out the splendor, the faded splendor, and the new life that's there, the life in the streets. It's very evident in the film, as you know. So it is a love story to that city and to their world.
How did you come across this subject, and how did you come across to the idea to make the documentary? Are you connected to Los Zafiros in any way?
No. I had been to Cuba as a visitor and went as a cultural exchange. I directed a play there in 93 with some American artists that went over by invitation. And I'm also a photographer, so I started taking images there. And frankly, no one had mentioned to me Los Zafiros in my times there. And so I actually, in New York, just purchased that album that's mentioned in the film, Bossa Cubana, which was a World Circuit release, sort of a greatest hits album from 97, 98. And I'm not a real doo-wop fan or anything like that, not really at all, but this sounded extremely special to me. And then when I read the story about the two guys that were surviving, and I found also that there was some footage available, great footage from Cuban television. Those things combined to get me interested in pursuing it.
And was it easy to make it there? Did you have an easy relationship with Cuban television? Were they happy to participate on this?
They actually were. It was astounding. It took about a year to get permission from the two guys, from Galban and Cancio, who, they weren't particularly wary, but they both wanted a chance to tell their stories in documentary form. We went there legally. This was in 2001 when we did our filming towards the end of the year, and it was a very strange time, right after 9/11. But we figured we better do it then or never do it at all. And as you know, things have gotten more difficult, between the two countries. The Cuban archives were great. They allowed us access to material we never would have been able to use. And that's what hopefully makes the film come alive, is being able to see these guys. Very professionally produced films, music videos, in effect, done there, and in black and white, artfully shot, artfully lit, and just treasures,
Had Galban and Cancio seen each other since the end of Los Zafiros?
They had seen each other during production of a feature film which was made by Miguel Cancio's son, Hugo Cancio, out of Miami, with a Cuban director and Cuban actors, called Los Zafiros Locura Azul, basically Blue Madness. And it's a film about the early days of the group and the formation that was made in 97, 98. But they had not played together until they came together for my film.
Well,
in many years, you know.
Right, right. Well, it's a very beautiful film. It's called Los Zafiros, Music from the Edge of Time. And are you going to be releasing the soundtrack? Are people going to be able to get a hold of that?
Yeah, the soundtrack comes out in July, mid-July, through Hepcat Records. And the DVD releases July 31st through Shout Factory. So after a long gestation, which often happens with films, especially documentary features, we'll finally be available in both those forms in July.
Well, Lorenzo DiStefano, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The film is called Los Zafiros, Music from the Edge of Time. It has been playing at the Santa Fe Film Center. I believe it's still there. Call the Film Center for more information on that at 988-5225. And thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I believe it opens there on the 11th.
Well, that's what I thought, too, but then I saw that it was playing this past weekend, so...
Oh, really? Well, they snuck some screenings in, all the better.
Yeah, well, we'll check their website, and let's listen to just a little bit more from Los Zafiros.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Llego a La Habana, beso a quien me da la gana, busco acaricia mejores, caminando va, guarachando va,
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista.